Welcome to Gravity, a podcast on the environment and human rights issues from the local to the global. The Chinese Communist Party occupied Tibet through armed force in October 1950, and it has maintained repressive and exploitative control since that time. The CCP has and continues to commit cultural genocide in Tibet, including most recently by forcing children as young as four to go to boarding schools where they are immersed in sinicization in an effort to wrest them away from their families and their culture and their language, and in this way, destroy Tibet. The CCP, after disappearing the Panchen Lama, has picked a puppet instead and has the audacity to proclaim it can pick the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. In an effort to obfuscate its repression in Tibet, the CCP has promoted tourism, which it tightly controls, so that Lhasa has luxury hotels next to political prisons where prisoners are tortured. The CCP has also committed ecocide in Tibet, rapaciously extracting gold, copper, lithium, and other vital elements that allow the CCP to make the cheap goods that propel its economy. Yet, the Tibetan people are not giving up. They have a thriving democratic government in exile and continue to strive for an independent and democratic Tibet. Tibet is the third pole, its glaciers vital for the drinking water of numerous Asian countries, as major Asian rivers from the Ganga to the Indus to the Mekong to the Yellow River, to name just a few, originate in Tibet. Yet while climate change discourse focuses on the north and south poles, there is little focus on this third pole, and Tibet is warming at an accelerated rate. We need to ramp up global mitigation efforts, and we need an adaptation strategy for the Tibetan plateau. Make no mistake, the CCP's occupation of Tibet is not simply an issue of grave injustice against the Tibetan people, but affects many more peoples. The CCP is building dams in Tibet, including what will be the biggest dam in the world, in seismically active territory that may lead to devastating earthquakes. Additionally, the CCP's dams allow it to control the valve for water to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other countries, and is of primary geopolitical concern. The Tibetan people have the right of self-determination and the right to their own resources, and no country should be able to control the valve for downstream riparian states. Just think how Turkey's selfish and myopic gap dams directly contributed to instability in the Middle East, including the Syrian civil war. Tibet's freedom is a right as well as a geopolitical necessity. Last month, I spoke with Dr. Lobsang Sangay, the former Prime Minister of Tibet, who currently teaches at Harvard Law School, on these issues and more. Welcome to Gravity FM, Lobsang.
Hey, good to be on your show, Gravity FM it is. Yes.
Thank you.
So good to see you online, you know, although from the East Coast and West Coast.
That's right. Great to see you again. So the CCP props up its armed occupation of Tibet by saying that Tibet has always been a part of China. It was a feudal society that it liberated. That no one can really speak about Tibet because no one's really gone. If you haven't gone, you can't criticize the CCP's actions. The records show that Tibet was independent since 127 BC, that it was not the monochromatic society that the CCP paints it to be, that the diaspora has a very thriving democratic mindset, and that the CCP really controls who can enter Tibet and where they can go. And it's always been a very repressive regime since the occupation. But since Xi Jinping has come in, he has intensified repression and sinicization of Tibet.
Yes, you know, it's interesting that the Chinese government always says that Tibet has always been part of China. You know, they insist. And they also say, well, you know, anyone can come to Tibet and see for themselves. But they won't tell you that even if you get a visa to go to China, you need additional visa or permit to go to Tibet. A visa to go to China is not enough for you to go to Tibet. So that means they're already, from travel point of view, from restriction point of view, there's another layer to prevent foreigners from going to Tibet. And number two, even the journalists, you know, who are based in Beijing, they cover generally East Asia, they say that it is more difficult to get access to Tibet than North Korea.
Ha!
And then the Freedom House Index, you know, they come out with the list of countries and regions every year. And last year, too, Tibet, you know, was listed as among the least free region in the whole world, comparable to Syria and other countries. So clearly, no matter what the Chinese government tried to say, you know, that Tibet has always been part of China. Anyone can come and see Tibetans are happy and welcoming. You know, they have embraced PRC. But then the fact that they need a separate visa to go to Tibet, the fact that journalists are not allowed, scholars are not allowed, you know, researchers are not allowed. And clearly, again, they publish, you know, annually, you know, I think three or four magazines on Tibet called China's Tibet. You know, they must put China's apostrophe S Tibet to indicate their ownership, you know, thereby exposing the fact that their guilt and paranoia about Tibet, you know. Otherwise, you would never see a magazine called China's Shanghai or China's Beijing or China's Guangdong. But there is a magazine with, you know, Tibetans wearing brand new clothes while farming, you know, and brand new clothes with a brand new watch in the factory. You know, so if you look at those photographs, you can clearly see all these choreographs, thereby indicating that, you know, well, you know, no matter what Chinese government says, they have this, you know, insecurity. That and the reality that Tibet was not part of China. As you said, Tibet was an independent country, which is under illegal occupation now. And then they try to justify around the world.
Yeah. And since Xi Jinping has been in power, he has intensified sinicization and repression in Tibet. And one thing that appears to be new and horrifying, I see it as a form of cultural genocide. In fact, I say cultural genocide because Lemkin's original neologism, his theory was encompassing cultural genocide within the definition of genocide, but the Western colonial powers resisted that at the UN, but I digress. But this is so appalling that they are taking children to boarding schools where they're not taught to the Tibetan language, they're not taught their culture, they're separated from their families, they're indoctrinated into this party allegiance and into Chinese nationality. Is this how the CCP is attempting to remove the Tibetan independent resistance by essentially molding the next generation as Chinese?
Yes. If you go further back in 1960s, International Commission of, you know, on the International Commission of Jurists based in Geneva, a major international organization, came out with a report that cultural genocide was going on in Tibet. Literally 98% of the monasteries and nunneries were destroyed. You know, 99.9% of monks and nuns were disrobed. Tibetan artifacts, Tibetan scriptures were burned, you know, broken down and then looted and sold, you know, all over the international market, which you can see at least in some of the museums around the Western world as well. And recent years, you know, when Xi Jinping took over, there was some hope that, you know, there might be some moderation on Tibetans because his father was a close friend of late Panchen Lama, you know, and also a liberal wing of the party because when there was a crackdown in Tiananmen Square, his father leaned towards progressive, you know, faction. But the son has not turned out to be like his father. And as you said, you know, and recent reports indicate that more than a million children are forcibly sent to boarding schools where everything about Communist Party, Chinese language, Chinese culture, Chinese history are taught. So that this is an assimilation drive to sinicize, make Tibetan children into Chinese. In fact, some parents have said that after sending these children to a boarding school, after a month, when they come back home, their nature, their habit changes. The way they used to hug their, you know, grandparents and just smile and, you know, run towards and, you know, grandparents, becomes kind of a cold, because they were taught that Tibet was a feudal system, backward system with barbarians, and we the Han Chinese came and civilized you people, and then their children, you know, they're very young. Yeah. You brainwash them with this propaganda, they kind of start believing this propaganda. So this is a major, you know, assault on Tibetan identity, Tibetan values, Tibetan culture, and it's a grave threat to Tibetan civilization. Having said that, I think, you know, ultimately Tibetan DNA, you know, the rugged mountain values and the grit that we have will prevail. You know, so after some years, I'm sure even these children, you know, when they realize the reality of what was Tibet and what are the Tibetan values, they will assert the Tibetan identity, because there is a saying that if your child is getting spoiled, send him or her to mainland China, they come back becoming more Tibetan. Because Han chauvinism and discrimination is very strong. Even those, you know, Chinese and Tibetans who are married to Chinese, half Tibetans, you know, if you call them, they also tend to be more Tibetan than Chinese, because they face the discrimination.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow they are told that you're lesser than Han Chinese, and that will ignite their Tibetan identity. So forcing million Tibetan children to boarding school is definitely a threat in assimilation drive. In a way, it's a culture genocide. But Tibetan identity is, you know, thousands of years old, and it will prevail.
Yes, it will. How else is the CCP denying freedom of religion and political expression within Tibet?
Now, religious, crackdown on, you know, religious institutions, you know, have been going on for decades now. As I said, when late Panchen Lama wrote a report in 1963, this is 2 years before the Cultural Revolution, that he sent a 70,000 characters petition to Chinese leader Mao Zedong at that time, and said 98% of monasteries and nunneries were destroyed, right? This is an assault on Tibetan religion. Then there was a lull because when Mao Zedong died and Gang of Four, collapsed, from mid-70s to, you know, 80s, there was a bit of a lull where there was a social space.
Yeah.
And the first thing Tibetans did was rebuild their monasteries and nunneries, you know, and the monks and nuns started joining monasteries and nunneries. And it just thrived because Tibetans are, by and large, a very, you know, religious person and a very spiritual. Spirituality is very important in Tibetan life. They did that. But then after 1990s, they saw this as a threat, and the crackdown happened again. For example, Sertha Monastery had about 20,000 monks and nuns, including a few thousand Han Chinese.
Huh.
And what happened, this is almost 10 years ago, bulldozer came in the name of sanitation and safety. This just bulldozed one-third, maybe 40% of the whole infrastructure. Now, it's important to know the Sertha Monastery was not built by anybody. There was a very famous teacher who attracted a lot of students from all over the world, including Han Chinese, and they built their own, you know, huts and small houses. That's how 20,000 came about. And then they just demolished it. And Yashingar Nunnery had 5,000 nuns. And if you Google Yashingar Nunnery, you will see that half of the nunnery is completely demolished, and they painted it green, so that it isn't, they want to remove any, you know, semblance of destruction. And then, breaking down or destroying the statues of Guru Padmasambhava, Buddha, monasteries, it's an ongoing effort. Now, most importantly, in any or every major monastery in Tibet has a Chinese military camp just outside. Police presence at the gate. And then what they're called, the Communist Party cell within the monastery, who will oversee what they call democratic committee, they call it democratic committee, but who will oversee who joins the monastery, who is recruited, you know, who is the teacher, their curriculum, recruitment process, prayer, everything is monitored by this, you know, democratic committee. So inside the monastery, outside police station, right outside there's a military camp. So this is how they control everything.
Oh. So you discussed just now how important religion is to the Tibetan identity, how important Buddhism is. And the Panchen Lama was disappeared and no one has seen him for, since he was, a little boy. And the CCP appointed their own Panchen Lama, supposedly, who is very much in line with the CCP's values. Oh, what a surprise. And also, it seems that the CCP wants to pick the reincarnation of the current Dalai Lama, who's in a few weeks, I believe, turning 90. How is this? How are they getting away with this? I mean,
what? So that's why, nowadays I keep speaking about Chinese world order. You know, what is Chinese world? There is some narrative and propaganda, whitewashing going on around the world. That the, you know, West-led world order has double standard, hypocrisy, you know, is, you know, vested in interest driven and all that, which, you know, partly all true, you know. But you must know what Chinese world order is, you know. Chinese world order can make their foreign minister disappear and no one in the government can question. Their defense minister disappear, no one can question. The generals are appointed and disappear. No one can question, right? So similarly, Panchen Lama, you know, actually it was Tashi Lumpu Monastery, which is the main base of late Panchen Lama. Their committee selected a boy and said he could be the next Panchen Lama. And then it was sent to India where Dalai Lama endorsed that boy, Gendun Choekyi Nyima, as the Panchen Lama. And then lo and behold, what did Chinese Communist Party do? They just kidnapped him and he has disappeared for now almost 30 years. A young boy.
Yeah.
They saw him as a threat to this, you know, China, PRC's regime and the Communist Party. He has disappeared. And in his place, they appointed a fake one, you know. Mm. And then there's a video that I think he recently met President Xi Jinping. That's an highest protocol, right? So they are trying to promote fake Panchen Lama to perform rituals, to lead or mislead Tibetans, and then preside over the selection of the next Dalai Lama, as you mentioned. So the fake Panchen Lama will select a fake Dalai Lama. And can you imagine the audacity? They say, we are communists. We don't believe in religion. Religion is poison. Religion has to be destroyed. And they criticize the solemnness Dalai Lama for his entire life. Now they're saying, oh, we, the atheist organization, will select the next religious leader. We, the Communist Party, who criticized Dalai Lama his entire life, will select the next Dalai Lama. And then what their audacity is, what they're saying is, we have more right to select the reincarnation of Dalai Lama than the Dalai Lama himself, you know. This is Dalai Lama's reincarnation. His incarnation is reincarnated. Is his choice where and when to be born. Now, fortunately, His Holiness Dalai Lama has made it very clear that he will be born outside of China. He will be not be born inside China because China is not free. Tibetans don't have freedom. So that is categorical and very clear.
Now, as repression is increasing in Tibet, tourism is also booming, mostly tourism from within China, but also tightly controlled tourism outside of China. You have to get that special permit that you were discussing before, and also you just can't go everywhere. You need to go with a tour guide, just like in North Korea, right? But I find it extraordinary that you have this luxury hotel next to Gutsa, which is a prison where they torture political prisoners. And they're right, they're literally, you know, within 2 minutes walking distance. Do you think that this tourism industry that the CCP is bolstering is an effort of the CCP to obfuscate and deny the repression within Tibet.
Yes, Tibet has become a major tourist destination. And 90%+ of the tourists are Han Chinese from China, interestingly. And many of them are Buddhists too, and many of them are nice. You know, they want to know Tibetan culture and embrace Buddhism as well. But then many of them are very, you know, noisy, you know, Chinese tourists, you know, who doesn't respect local culture, things like that. So it has created its own tension. But like you mentioned, there is, you know, percentage of tourists who are a luxury category. They come there to see wild animals, you know, they come there to see some exotic stuff, and they are given, provided this package tours. And they have no idea that the hotel is next to a prison, you know. A hotel is next to a demolished monastery. And it's and curated in such a way that they have, they are trying to have a normal experience in a very abnormal environment, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, they come out thinking, oh, I went to this very exotic mountain and saw exotic animals and, you know, hiking and trekking, but they have no idea the repression is going on. So all those tourists who go to Tibet, we always encourage them as much as possible, you know, to read more and watch more about Tibet before going inside, so that, you know, your contribution to the local economy will benefit local, you know, Tibetans.
Yeah.
Then cause harm to Tibetan people.
And I have been reading, and I'm not sure if this is accurate, there has been an increase in the incidence of self-immolation in Tibet in recent years as a protest to the increased repression on Tibetan society. Is this occurring?
Yes. Since 2010, there has been self-immolation where Tibetans, you know, pour gas or gasoline over their body and burn themselves. The first one was 2010, and the rest of 136 or 7 of them, majority of them took place during my time when I was the, you know, prime minister and later president of the Tibetan community in exile. So it was a very sad phase of Tibet's history. Literally, you know, Tibetans are pouring gas over their body and then burn themselves. And then 90% of them die. And then you ask why. Now the genesis as to why they're doing this lies solely with the Communist Party of China. Because in Tibet, whenever there were, you know, there were peaceful protests in 1990s and 2008, there's always been a peaceful protest all over Tibet. They arrest you, they imprison you, they torture you in such a way that you either die in prison, and when they release you also, you are so malnourished, ill-treated, that you are sick, and then you become a burden to the family, and then you die soon thereafter. So that's why the Tibetans started thinking, you know, if I protest, I'll be tortured anyways, and it'll cause a lot of mental and physical harm to me, and emotional and psychological damages to my family members, because they will be under surveillance. They will be discriminated. You know, they will be, I know, harassed. So therefore, it's better for me to pour gasoline over my body, burn myself, and die quickly. So that, you know, that my family members don't have to suffer much. So that is the form of, you know, protest is taking place in Tibet. It's really sad. So that shows that Tibetans are really desperate, and situation in Tibet is very dire.
Yeah. So Tibetan Buddhism it's visceral to the Tibetan identity, and a part of the religion is nonviolence. How is the Tibetan resistance informed by Buddhist nonviolence?
No, I went through this debate. In Buddhism, we consider any harm caused to anybody, is violence. In this one, so is it a violent death? Yes. But is it violence? No. Because violence means you must harm someone or something. So even though 137 Tibetans have burned themselves, right? You could pour gas over your body and run towards a police station or any Chinese barrack or a Chinese, police or officials, anybody. But they don't. They pour gas over their body and burn themselves and not damage any property or person and not even a Chinese, authority or authorities.
Yeah.
So do they die a violent death? Yes. But are they harming others? No. Thereby, that's what they said. So it is not violence, but it is a violent death. So that's why, when I was in my official position, I always urged Tibetans not to commit self-immolation. Number one, life is precious.
Yeah.
Number two, we must live and continue our freedom struggle. Each life is precious. And one should contribute for our cause non-violently and for a very long time. Having said that, anyone who commits self-immolation and dies, I held a prayer for them. But then I do, and all the Tibetans do, support their aspirations. Their aspirations were they want to see the return of Dalai Lama to Tibet, and they want to see freedom for Tibetans.
Yeah.
These are the basic demands. These are the basic demands and aspirations of, now 7 million Tibetans in Tibet.
Yeah. And so we've been discussing the human rights violations and really the crimes against humanity that the CCP is committing in Tibet, but it's also committing ecocide. Tibet is very rich in natural resources, which is probably why the CCP is there. Tibet has a lot of water. China lacks water. Tibet has lithium, copper, nickel, gold, to name a few of the very important elements that power essentially the Chinese economy and allow it to have such cheap goods in the world. And it is polluting the water and the land of Tibet. Can you tell me more about the ecocide that the CCP is committing in Tibet and also the imprisonment of environmental defenders?
There's a lot of talk about critical minerals, highlighted by Ukraine war in Ukraine, that Ukraine has a lot of, rare earth and other critical minerals. So they're signing a deal agreement with America and Europe and all that, right? And Russia is there mainly to occupy those territories which are fertile and rich in mineral resources, right? But Tibet is actually far richer in mineral resources. You just name it. There are 136 different kinds of critical minerals in Tibet. Uranium, gold, copper, 75% of lithium reserve of China is in Tibet. Second largest copper mine is in Tibet, right?
Mm.
And then borax, you just name it. And that no wonder the term, Chinese term, Xizang, means Western treasure. So they knew there was a treasure in the West. That's how they occupied Tibet. We must know that original China, where Han Chinese inhabited for thousands of years, is only 40% of the land of present-day China. Almost 25% of the territory is Tibet. Maybe 17% of the territory is Uyghur region, we call Xinjiang also. And then Inner Mongolia, is around that size as well. There's Manchuria. If you take all that, right, the west, northwest, and the northeast of China, that's 60% of the territory which China occupied. So China is an expansionist empire. They want to, because in my class also I showed, right, there's a Great Wall of China.
Mm.
That is the border of China for centuries, right?
Yeah.
So many emperors spend their treasury to renovate and rebuild the Great Wall to prevent what they call northern barbarians, Tibetans and Mongolians and Manchus from invading Tibet. So, you know, Chinese are so proud. They say that, oh, you can see the Great Wall even from Moon, right?
Yeah.
So that was the border, you know, for centuries. Now, where is the Great Wall of China now? It's inside China, right? The Inner Mongolia was an independent country, you know, under Yuan Dynasty. And before that, you know, for the Mongol Dynasty lasted for almost 600 years. So now all this territory outside a Great Wall are now within the quote-unquote boundary of China. So they crossed their own wall, the border, and occupied all these territories, and then they call it China. So the way they have expanded land territory, they're expanding into the sea territory. That's where there's a tension, you know, with South China Sea and East China Sea, ongoing clashes with Philippines, mainly for resources, right? So 90% of the rare earth of China comes from Inner Mongolia. Ah. 40% of, you know, iron and, you know, oil of China comes from Uyghur region. 80% of cotton comes from Uyghur region. So all these territories are very rich in natural resources. So that's why Chinese government is committing ecocide. And then in partnership with many of the Western companies, actually, many of the Western companies are using their, you know, technology and investing in Chinese companies to exploit, you know, critical minerals in Tibetan area, Uyghur region, Mongolian region, Manchu region. Yes.
Atrocious. And the other thing that the CCP is doing that's causing environmental destruction, apart from the mining of minerals, is the damming project. They have 193 dams that they plan to build across Tibet. They've already built numerous dams across Tibet, and these dams have displaced people. They've flooded cultural and religious sites, and they're not good for the environment, actually, for the healthy flora and the fauna. Can you tell me more about the problems of the dams, which are not for Tibet, right? They're not for Tibetan electricity. They're for Chinese hydropower.
You know, China has built, you know, thousands of, you know, dams, small, medium, and large dams. But just large dams, medium size and large dams, China has built 400 plus dams in Tibet. Now on Brahmaputra River, you know, which flows from Tibet to India to Bangladesh, they have planned to build a dozen dams, of which three or four are already being built. Now they're planning to build the biggest dam, bigger than Three Gorges Dam. Three Gorges Dam is the biggest in China and biggest in the world. They're trying to build bigger than that because that bend has a strong water force and it can generate more power than Three Gorges Dam of China. Why is the Chinese government building so many dams? For hydropower. Now, do Tibetans need any additional energy? No. Tibetans have excess of energy given the hydropower that Tibet has, right? But they're building all this to generate energy for their data centers, you know. Mm. We always talk about deep, you know, the DeepSeek, the Chinese AI tool and all that. Why China is competitive in AI? Because you need lots of energy. Where do the energy come from? Tibet, Mongolia, Uyghur region, right? So that's why they're building all these dams for their energy. And then do Tibetans benefit from it? No. And then because, you know, now the scientists have already established this fact, there is a causality, a definite correlationship between damming and earthquakes.
Yeah.
In October of last year, there was a major earthquake in Thingri region of Tibet. Hundreds died. And then there was a shutdown of internet. We don't know. But definitely hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of damages were done. Infrastructure, all the houses were collapsed, right? Now, this is not the first time. In 2008, there was a, you know, major earthquake in Sichuan, and then other Tibetan area, right? and in Nepal and in Sikkim, you know, and in Bhutan and Afghanistan, Pakistan. You just, you know, see this whole Himalayan region has so many earthquakes happening now more frequently because of damming of Tibetan plateau and Tibetan region. Mm. Because once you dam, you hold all this water, and the water, you know, seeps through all these cracks, right?
Right.
And it pushes the tectonic shifts, you know. And already the Tibetan area, that whole Himalayan belt, is a very sensitive earthquake prone area. They, if you grade it, it's from 1 to 4. It's number 4. It's the highest.
Right.
If you build all these dams. And that they're just doing it for selfish purposes to generate more energy for AI, you know, so for their data centers.
Yeah.
So, you know, whenever we say, oh, Chinese produces things very cheaply, people, you know, don't realize that they produce things cheaply at the back of China, of Tibetan minerals, mm-hmm. Tibetan water, Mongolian water, you know, Mongolian critical minerals, and, you know, Uyghur critical minerals. So,
yeah, where they're committing heinous human rights violations against the local populations in all those areas. And probably the control is to ensure the control of these resources. So when we talk about Tibet, we've talked about these grievous, like egregious human rights violations, which of themselves make Tibet a global issue. China says it's an internal issue, but that in itself makes it a global issue, apart from the fact that they occupied an independent state to begin with. But thirdly, if we look at Tibet and the origin of major rivers, so we talked about the Brahmaputra, where they want to put a 60-megawatt dam at the bend. There's the Yangtze, the Yellow River, the Mekong, the Indus, the Ganges. This is incredible. Nearly 20% of the world's population relies on the rivers that originate in Tibet. So when China builds this dam right on the Brahmaputra, it's actually a global problem. It's a geopolitical issue for downstream because they can lower the water level. They can flood if they want to because they have that ability with the dam. And it makes me think of Turkey in the 70s when they built the Greater Anatolian Project and didn't care at all about their downstream neighbors down the Tigris and Euphrates, which lowered the water level significantly. And then we've had conflict in the Middle East, partly due to the issues of water. I mean, the Syrian civil war is a direct consequence of Turkey not caring. So I wonder, why is Tibet not a major global issue when China can just have a valve controlling the world's water?
You know, like you said, I try to make this argument that the first and second pole are very well known. And
yeah.
You know, scientists travel there, do research, and billions of dollars are invested to study first and second pole. But Tibet is also called the third pole. An argument can be made that Tibetan plateau is more important than Antarctic and Arctic, because when the glaciers of Antarctic and Arctic melt, they go to ocean. It becomes salt water. It's not drinkable. Right. But when the glaciers, there are 40,000 glaciers in Tibet, when they melt, it forms streams, it forms rivers. It's a lifeline for all those countries downstream. For example, Brahmaputra is a lifeline for northeast of India and Bangladesh. You know, the cradle of Chinese civilization, Yellow River, Yangtze River, where all the Han Chinese people, you know, if you look at Han Chinese people, they inhabited it around Yellow and Yangtze River, right? Mm. Between these two rivers, you know? So that's where the Chinese civilization was founded. And then you're right, in Irrawaddy, Mekong River, lifeline for Southeast Asia, all flow from Tibet. Indus and Sutlej River, they flow from Tibet to Kashmir to Pakistan, right? So of the, you know, 10 largest rivers of Asia, I think 6 or 7 flow from Tibet, including, as you mentioned, Ganges. So Tibet is very, very important. 1.4 billion people of that area depend on water flowing from Tibet. So Tibet is also called the roof of the world, water tower of Asia. You know, if you have read the World Economic Forum crisis report of 2015, I think, there were 10 crises, including war and famine and poverty. Number one was water crisis.
Yeah.
Tibet holds the largest reservoir of water and is a lifeline for that area, which means India and China and Bangladesh, three of the largest populated countries in the whole world.
Yeah. And aside from the damming issue, there's climate change, right? Like Tibet is at the forefront of the climate crisis. And like we discussed just now, all these people rely on freshwater from Tibetan glaciers, but Tibet is losing, I think, 8 billion tons of ice a year from glaciers. It's warming at 3 times the rate of the global average. Climate change is accelerated in Tibet. And so what strikes me is that climate discourse, as you talk about the two poles, but the third pole is so important, and yet it's not prominent in climate discourse, but it really should be the center and forefront of climate change mitigation and adaptation policies.
Yes, climate change is a major issue, has been a major issue, and it will be more critical in coming decades. Now, like you said, by 2030, the snow cover over the mountains of Tibet will be less than the melting of the glaciers, meaning the replenishment of the Tibetan glaciers will decrease after 2030. So more snow will melt than it will be covered with snow. So that's a turning point. You know, we were talking in 5 years' time. So what happens, the glaciers of Tibet melt and disappear forever. So it's so critical, even the Chinese environmentalists are saying that we should declare Tibet as the third pole national reserve or national park so that the Tibetan plateau can be preserved. And the whole of Himalayan belt, and two-thirds of it is Tibet, right? So it's a very delicate area. So when there's 1 degree rise of temperature, rest of the world, there'll be 2 degrees of rise in the Tibetan plateau. And the glaciers start melting faster because direct sun hits, you know, because of the plateau, because it's so high,
yeah.
It hits, you know, harder, and then it melts faster. So, you know, it is, in fact, a threat to China and Chinese people as well. That's where Chinese scientists are in raising alarms, and definitely for the whole of Asia. Now, instead of protecting it, you know, the urbanization of Tibetan plateau, they're bringing more Chinese to Tibetan areas, right? And the militarization of Tibetan plateau, and then the exploitation of all these critical minerals of Tibet is, you know, heating up the Tibetan plateau so fast that, you know, there could be a day there will be no snow covering Mount Everest. So this is, you know, a threat to the whole world, particularly in Asia. And hence Tibetan plateau and Tibet is very, very important as a lifeline for whole of Asia.
Yeah. Now, I want to move on to the Tibetan government in exile, the democratically elected government. You were the prime minister for 2 terms, so from 2011
to 2021, yes.
Yeah. So can you tell me, how does Tibet run a democratically elected government from Dharam Sala? And what does it do for Tibetans within Tibet and the diaspora?
You know, I think, you know, there are like 60 exiled communities, even more if you take into consideration small ones. But among all the exiled communities, Tibetan government exile is the most effective functioning government, like any other government. In fact, the Tibetan government exile's record is, you know, comparable or better than many of the governments of independent countries. By which I mean, you know, for example, the literacy rate of Tibetans in exile is around 94-96%. Now, literacy rate of India is 82%, right? So Tibetan literacy rate is higher than Nepal and, you know, Bangladesh and so on and so forth, in that whole Pakistan, Southeast Asia. So as refugees, we have done better than our own host country and neighboring countries. And Tibetans are pretty self-reliant. You know, they are very, hardworking entrepreneurs as well. So Tibetan government, actually, we run our own schools through education department. We run our own hospitals through the health department. We run our own, oversee, 300 plus monasteries and nunneries and thousands of monks and nuns. And we have like 13 semi-embassies around the world. We call them offices of Tibet. We run our own bank and finance, so we raise our own funds and also solicit funds from international community. So this is the most, not just most effectively run government, but also the most frugally run government. Our budget is only about $50 million a year, but we provide education to 10,000 students, and all these hospitals and, clinic and office around the world. So, this is, and then we have a functioning parliament. And interestingly, the most watched show in the Tibetan world is not Netflix or any K-drama, but is the Tibetan parliamentary session, because there's a lot of drama in the Tibetan parliament. So it's a lively, thriving democracy that, the world can be very proud. And this is definitely a great legacy of His Holiness Dalai Lama and hard work of the elder generation. So I'm finishing my book now on democracy in exile, which I wrote dissertation 20 years ago. And then I made an argument that democracy is regressing, And my supervisors and everybody say, what, democracy is not regressing? It's thriving. It's, end of history, Fukuyama, Berlin Wall collapse, the Soviet Union collapse. There are more countries becoming democratic, Samuel Huntington and his third wave. I concluded that, right? And then I managed to get my, dissertation through. And after 20 years in 2011, when I, 2021, when I came back to Harvard and the Kennedy School, when I took the class, the title of the class was Democratic Backsliding, which I said 20 years ago,
Yeah.
And the Freedom House has come out with a report that for the last 19 consecutive years, democracy has declined or backslided, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. I predicted that in 2004 when I wrote my dissertation. Since 2005, democracy has been backsliding. So I've been proven right in the sense now I'm coming out with a book, which will be a manual, a read for all the exiled communities on how to set up and run democratic government in exile. So with Tibetan government as the focus.
So what is your advice to governments in exile when they, it seems to me, have these two competing interests, right? They have to show unity against the occupier of their homeland in an effort to regain their homeland, right? But then on the other hand, to encourage democratic rivalry and everything that we just spoke about that is democracy, so that you have these really live debates that are entertaining as well. So they seem to be competing interests. So what is the best practice to sustain democracy, but also unity?
Yes, so that's why I've come out with this book, 10 Challenges. So if because I think if not 90%, at least 75% of the government exiles collapses and don't succeed, mainly because they face 10 challenges and they didn't know about it once they, face the challenges. And then, many of them collapse. So number one challenge is this philosophical and ideological contradiction between the two. So if you are freedom in exile, you have one goal, one leader, and unity is very important, But then if you say democracy instead of, one leader, there has to be opposition party. Instead of one voice, there has to be, freedom of speech. And instead of unity, there has to be diversity. So there's a fundamental contradiction between the two. So how do you navigate that? Right? How to balance the two is very important. So that's why the conventional definition of democracy, from Schumpeter, Dahl, all the way to Larry Diamond and the rest, they study and teach democracy, which assumes territory and a state. Right? Now, yes, and all the definition that you have read, taught, all the textbook is about democracy with territory and a state. Now, I am coming out with the definition of democracy without state, democracy without borders, right? So my argument is that this definition so far that we have is limited does not include democracy in exile. And democracy in exile must take into consideration their own challenges and circumstances. This is not cultural relativism, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a reality. You are in exile, so you must, you know, navigate this too. Unity and diversity, single voice and freedom of speech and opposition and single leader, right? So how do you navigate that? Right. So that, and then choosing a host country is very important. Either host country can derail you or make you succeed. And then infighting, you know, and then raising funds. You know, funding is very important. At the same time, corruption will derail you, you know. So all these challenges one must know. The main argument that I make is, for example, recently President Trump met with the new leader of Syria, right, of the interim government. Now, the issue is, can Syria become democratic, right? So my argument is that if you are not democratic in exile, chances of you becoming democratic back home is less.
Mm.
But if you are non-democratic in exile, chances of you becoming non-democratic back home is higher. For example, if you are theocrat, Khomeini, Ayatollah, then you become theocrat. And if you're a monarch, you know, whether you're Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia or Shah of Iran, you become, a king back home. If you are Bolshevik, you know, like Lenin in exile, then you become Bolshevik back home. So if you're Mujahideen in exile, if you're Taliban in exile, you become Mujahideen Taliban exile. So if you look at the Syrian leader, he was an Islamicist and a militant leader. What are the chances that he will become democratic back home in Syria? Little less. If you study the, you know, Arab Spring, many of those countries which actually overthrew dictators like Hosni Mubarak and of in Egypt and Gaddafi of, you know, Libya and so on and so forth, all are being replaced by, you know, dictators or semi-authoritarian, you know, leaders now, you know.
Yeah.
So my argument that I make is that if you want to see democracy back home, you must be democratic in exile. If you're not democratic in exile, you won't be democratic back home. So that's why forming exile government within a democratic processes and democratic election, so one must learn this process. Democracy is an acculturation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You must embrace this. You must practice this. Through practice, it becomes part of your values and part of your ethos. So when you go back home, you demand democracy, you demand election, you demand freedom of speech because you have been through this.
Yes.
So acculturation is very important. So, and then also, if you have never run a government, you can't replace dictators. You can remove dictators, replace them. You must know how to run a government. You must know how to run a finance department, an education department, agriculture department, technology department, finance and foreign department or ministry. If you don't know how to run these things, even if you're given a department, after 5 years, you'll be thrown out because you don't know how to govern it, right? So to become a successful, especially a democratic government back home, you must practice democracy in exile.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you were the prime minister for 2 terms, and now you teach at Harvard Law School. And I know that you do many conferences around the world. And my question is, you have really fought for your people. And I don't mean obviously violently, but you've really been there for your people. And as far as I understand, you've been prohibited from going to Tibet. So what is your personal experience of having Tibet so close to your heart and looking after so many Tibetans and yet not being allowed to go to the homeland that is so visceral to who you are?
Yes, I've been an activist, you know, since young, and then formally at the age of 18, I think. So now I'm 58. So it's been almost like 40 years, you know, I've been in this struggle. Yes, I am a Tibetan freedom fighter who is, you know, who is not allowed to see Tibet. You know? So I'm fighting for a country that I've never been and never seen. And I'm fighting for a cause that I only think of, you know, but have never felt the soil of Tibet. But then, yes, you know, my parents, my community, and our leader, His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, as a Tibetan, on the one hand, we have no option. On the other hand, we must do everything possible to keep the issue alive and keep fighting for what is just, what is right, what is basic human rights and freedom for everybody, you know. So if you don't keep fighting, and then you lose the war. If you keep fighting, you might lose some battles, but eventually you will win the war in nonviolent sense, right?
Yeah.
So that keeps me going. Invited, actually, you know, so encouraged to come see Tibet for myself. And I went to Beijing and I spent 1 week there and then made, you know, rounds of appeals saying, you should allow me to go to Tibet. That's what you said. You should come and see for yourself. Lobsang, you talk propaganda. You have no idea the reality inside Tibet. And I said, of course, I want to see the reality. They never allowed me to see Tibet. And then that's been a disappointment. And then that, in fact, emboldened and encouraged me to realize that this is the region I'm talking about, right, dealing with. That on the one hand, they say, hey, you come for yourself and see what's going on. When you actually go there, they prevent you from seeing. Actually, in 2005, I was nobody. I was just a researcher at Harvard, you know. And even they didn't even allow a researcher to go for personal family reasons, just for a visit. But can you imagine that what they would do if you are a journalist or if you are, you know, a reporter, if you are a politician, you know, they'll prevent you from visiting Tibet mainly because they don't want to see the harsh reality. Because any day if there's a referendum in Tibet, I'm pretty sure Tibetans in Tibet will vote for a Tibetan leader, not a Chinese leader. That's what the Chinese government is afraid of. That's what the Communist Party of China is afraid of.
So are there any specific actions that our listeners can take to help Tibet?
And I would say, you know, please follow Tibetan news. You know, you can Google or, you know, and every day use Tibet as a keyword. You can follow Tibetan Government Exiles website, tibet.net. And then there are Students Free Tibet. There are a lot of Tibetan, you know, Tibet-related organizations. You can follow them and keep yourself updated. And then whenever you meet, you know, leaders, please do raise the issue of Tibet. And you can always write to, you know, media like you're doing, you know, have your own shows, you know, and any media platform, social media platform, you know, keep sharing and raising the issue of Tibet. And on July 6th is the birthday of His Holiness, the great 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet. We all must join. Whole world should come. Join and celebrate his birthday. And most importantly, know and share his legacy. He was a great leader and still is a great leader. Not just for Tibetans, not just for Buddhists around the world, but for the whole world.
You know, yes.
For compassion and nonviolence and peace, you know. He exudes that, he reflects that, he symbolizes that. And in this day and age, we need his leadership and especially his message.
Oh, agreed. Yes, happy 90th birthday to the Dalai Lama. Lobsang, I'm so grateful for your time and insight today. I can't wait to read your upcoming book. And I hope that in our lifetimes, if not far sooner, we will see a free Tibet. Tashi Dalek.
Tashi Dalek. Thank you so much. Yes. Good to be on your show. And I wish all the listeners, you know, enjoyable, maybe, you know, not so positive, you know, development in Tibet, but hopefully this will encourage and inspire you to work for justice and freedom anywhere and everywhere in the world. Thank you.
Yes, to freedom in Tibet and everywhere.
Thank you.
I hope you have found this podcast insightful and will join us next time as we explore more issues affecting our environment and human rights at home and around the world. For more materials on this issue, please go to our website, thegravity.fm.